Okay, so I suspect among this group listening to something like that, there's quite a range of reactions and feelings. Some of you, as you listen to it, probably feel a familiar glow of music that draws you into an attitude of praise and worship. Others may be baffled that such music is used in Sunday services at all. Some people probably are slightly unsettled at hearing such music outside the bounds of a church community, finding it strange to sit and listen in a pub to something that is usually part of a community experience. And others probably cringe at a music which you find it hard not to make certain kinds of judgments about. I want to give a quotation that describes one particular reaction to contemporary worship music that, depending on who you hang out with, may or may not be familiar. And let me just switch applications. Okay, so this is someone that I interviewed. He says, "So I think contemporary worship music is even more lame than 90s pop. The harmonies are awful, you know, there's no, like, there's a verse, a chorus and a bridge and that's it. And there's no attempt to do anything different." So whilst there are many people who love and appreciate contemporary worship music as a genre, there are also a great number who find it to be problematic. Finding that they identify more closely with other kinds of music that they encounter elsewhere. If I tell you that this particular person frequently sings with a prominent Oxford choir, then their reaction to the music is perhaps a fairly predictable one. As someone who's spent time with pastoral responsibility in this kind of situation, it's often the negative reactions to the music of the church that cause the biggest questions to be raised. Some people, after they spend time in this kind of worship environment, find it doesn't suit them. They find it's problematic and they escape to other churches where they find a musical setup which suits them better. Many don't. Many find a home there. Many do something between. They find that they experience certain kinds of negative reactions to the music, but they remain part of a community and deal with those tensions in a variety of ways. Many people have mixed experience. It's not all kind of black and white. So this quotation, for example, continues. He says, "But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's good because it means that people can learn just four chords and can play like most worship songs, which I think is great. I don't think it's the function of worship music. It doesn't need to be harmonically interesting. I think it should be about the lyrics." So, musical value judgments are often more complex and nuanced than simply categorising music as good and bad. And once certain kinds of musical assessment have been made, whatever these are, there always remains the challenge of what to do with these, either as individuals or as a church body. So in this case, guided by a particular understanding of the purpose of worship music, the individual in question sets aside certain kinds of value judgment in favour of other priorities that they believe are equally or even more valuable. So the question I'm going to be talking about this evening, and the question that's at the heart of my doctoral research, centres on what exactly individuals do when the music of the church, specifically in a contemporary worship music setting, differs in important ways from the music they're at home with in other contexts. So what happens when contemporary worship music is not their music? Okay, so let me just give a quick overview of where contemporary worship music came from. I want to make it clear that I'm not talking about all church music here. I'm talking about a particular tradition that I spent a lot of time in and have had a very positive, a very mixed, I've had all kinds of relationship with. And part of my research is working out my own experiences as much as those of other people. Some of this will be relevant to other forms of church music, but a lot of it is also quite specific to this genre. So although it had a number of different precursors, contemporary worship music really began to take off in the 1960s in California. So it emerged out of a desire to relate the music of the church in some way to the music's familiar as part of popular culture, and in particular the hippie counterculture that was making impact in that time and place. Originally it took the forms of rock and folk and was centred largely around the aim of evangelisation. A Christian message was inserted lyrically into familiar musical forms with the hope that this would be a way of reaching out to certain parts of the surrounding culture. And say the best known artist here is a guy called Larry Norman, who some of you may have come across and who I'm mainly familiar with through my parents' record collection. So over the course of time, this music evolved, and the purpose turned away from evangelisation to include worship. In the 1980s, this led to music focused around an easy listening kind of adult style. There were two main foci. There was upbeat praise music that would be used towards the beginnings of worship service and focused on the corporate act of coming before God. And there were intimate worship songs focused much more on intense, emotional, individual devotion. And so the genre of the worship ballad became incredibly influential, with an intimate, sentimental focus. Many people found that this kind of music enabled them to encounter God in new and exciting ways, but many also found such music easy to criticise, giving rise to such labels as Jesus is my boyfriend music. Such criticisms of this genre perhaps paved the way for more recent forms of contemporary worship music, which are often more centred around guitar-driven rock and more around youth styles than the adult styles of the 1980s. They often centre more on the greatness and grandeur of God than intimacy. And that's exemplified perhaps by the musical example I started with. So here we have artists that are probably familiar, names such as Chris Tomlin, Tim Hughes, Delirious. And by this point in its history, worship music has become clearly established not only as a genre, but as an industry, with its own charts and with labels that have been successful enough to be bought up by the likes of EMI. In the UK, contemporary worship music has largely made its presence felt through the Charismatic Renewal, and is largely associated at present with charismatic evangelical churches, both inside and outside the Anglican establishment. It isn't, however, limited to these settings, and it's found a place within other evangelical churches and also more middle-of-the-road settings, and some songs even making their way into recent denominational hymnals. So, for example, the most recent edition of Hymns Ancient and Modern includes a number of worship songs from at least the 1990s, perhaps from the 2000s as well. So contemporary worship music is partly a shorthand kind of way of referring to any music which uses popular styles in worship. But it also comes with a particular history laden with particular kinds of ideology. So a key part of the history of contemporary worship music, and one that played a large role in setting the stage for the current way it's thought about, is the so-called worship wars. So the introduction of popular forms of music into church services is at least initially caused fairly strident forms of opposition, and this provided space for a great deal of discourse and debate. In the United States, but also in the UK, an important part of this centred around the music's debased moral connotations. So rock music was the music of sex and drugs, but it also led to slightly more strident denunciations as the devil's music. And on the weirder side of the scale, there were articles detailing the fact that if you played this kind of music to pot plants, they died. And this proved its harmful effects. So one response to the idea that this kind of music was debased or evil or just generally unhelpful because of its other cultural connotations, the other settings it's found in, and a response that's been quite influential in the way we talk about worship music in current times, is the assertion that music can't be evil because music is a neutral medium. So to respond to the argument that certain musical genres were inherently negative, part of response was to assert that music wasn't the kind of thing that carried meaning with it, and instead that meaning was located elsewhere, often in the lyrics. So to quote a 2010 book on the subject of Christian metal, they say this. They say, music is not intrinsically evil, no matter what the genre. It is just a series of benign beats and rhythms strung together. Until someone puts lyrics to it, there is no meaning. Disco, rhythm and blues, heavy metal, black metal and death metal, no matter what the style, all of it is just music and neutral, if you will. Music is like a tabula rasa of sorts. Only when lyrics are incorporated do the songs take on any meaning at all. So as a result of this kind of debate, in much talk about contemporary worship music, we've ended up with something of a dichotomy set up between the idea that music, that meaning is inherent to musical sounds themselves, the idea that music is of itself inherently meaningless, both of which, to my eyes as a musicologist, seem like slightly extreme attitudes. And this kind of ontology of music extends beyond a single debate and often guides a great deal of musical activity and discussion. If music is neutral and meaningless, for example, then people's musical attachments and tastes don't really matter that much. Instead, they can be considered to be the result of personal preference. And as a result, they have no claim to be taken seriously beyond the individual, or even really on that level a lot of the time. Personal preference for a particular kind of music is something that should be possible to lay to one side without any particular consequence. The result, negative experiences of the musical content of church are often therefore seen as an individual's own problem and no one else's. Moreover, a desire to assert one's own musical values within a church community can, as a result, begin to be seen simply as a matter of politics and a claim to power. Musical values, then, are often something to avoid talking about. There are further consequences too, and they're equally significant. Because it's seen as largely neutral, music is often seen as an element that potentially distracts from the elements of real significance within a service. What really matters, it's often argued, within worship are matters of a heart attitude. So this rationale often serves to guide the musical life of a church. If music, when it becomes a focus of attention, is simply a distraction, then there will be no reason to do anything novel. And there will be no reason to do anything that would in any way stand out or differ from the regular pattern. If music's meaningless, it can't really be anything other than a distraction when it's different. Music then becomes locked into established patterns simply because they've become established. So part of my reason for questioning these kinds of understandings, an increasing awareness over time that prevailing ways of talking about music within this part of the church, part of which I've just outlined, often fall short of providing helpful answers to more problematic situations. The suggestion that musical value judgments are simply personal preference can often fall short of coming to terms with what is really going on, just as much as the opposing idea that rock music is inherently evil or worthless can do the same. Talk about music in these situations has often become disconnected from the realities of experience. And I believe it's set important areas of conversation to one side from the life of the church. So my research. Over the last couple of years, I've been spending time as a researcher trying to better understand some of the ways in which musical experience in a church setting matters to people. In doing so, my particular interest has been in how they relate the music they experience in a church context to their musical experience outside of that setting. People's musical tastes and attachments have become increasingly diverse in recent history, bringing into question any assumption that a congregation will all have similar musical backgrounds. And the relationship between people's musical lives in and outside of church is an important one. When people express frustrations with the music of church, their reference point will often be the music that they appreciate elsewhere. Often this music is in some sense chosen by them in a way that the music of a church community might not be. And it's often reflective of some of the things that they believe to be valuable. This is not to say that they expect the music of the church to be the same as the music they value elsewhere. Distinctions are often made, and no doubt should be made, between the music of worship and the music of life outside of that setting. However, it is to say that the relationship between these two areas of music is significant and can lead to important insights. I've been carrying out my fieldwork at St Aldate's Church, just down the road. It's a community I've been part of for over 10 years now, although it's currently just one of a range of church settings that I'm within. St Aldate's, for those of you who may be less familiar with the church, is in many ways fairly typical as a charismatic Anglican church, at least in terms of what it does musically. It's part of the New Wine Network, and it's an influential part of it, thus having a fair degree of influence and connection with other Anglican charismatic churches in the UK, and it therefore serves as a good case study for wider patterns. My research itself centres around 40 or so extended interviews with different members of the congregation and leadership. So I selected individuals to interview largely on the basis that their own musical tastes and attachments seem both significant to them and in some way seem to diverge from the kind of music routinely employed on a Sunday. I found these tended to be the kind of people where issues of musical style and significance are most intense, and they often the kinds of people who are often best able to articulate their feelings about these things. They're not entirely representative of the church as a whole, but I hope they're illuminating of a range of experience. So in my interviews, which I carried out early in 2012, I asked people to tell me two things. I asked them to describe or give a narrative of their musical life as a whole, and then to do the same for their experience of music within the church. As they told these two stories, I tried to focus them in on questions of meaning and significance rather than pure surface description. And as things progressed through the interviews, I tried to explore a little the possible connections or divergences between the two narratives. Of course, in doing this, I'm creating a slightly artificial divide in the stories, but as the research progressed, it seemed to be a fruitful one to use. So having carried out the interviews, I tried to find ways of organising the different things that people were telling me. And fairly early on, I landed on three categories that I found useful as a framework for thinking about what people were saying. So I'm going to outline a bit, a few different examples within each of these categories, and then I'll briefly draw it all together and draw out what I think are some of the implications of it. So the categories: bridging worlds through common modes of being in music, number one. Boundaries, communal and private, spiritual and secular, number two. And the edges, value transfer, judgments, discontent, number three. Okay. First one. So what I'm looking at in this first category is the way in which people form connections between seemingly quite different musical environments. The malleability or the flexibility of musical experience often enables common themes, approaches and understandings to be found between musical environments which are often quite different. So let me give you an example. Graham plays horn in the Oxford Symphony Orchestra. He also plays regularly within the St Aldate's worship bands. And these two settings are potentially quite divergent in nature. They're very different performance contexts, very different genres of music. You have a symphony orchestra playing big romantic symphonies, you have a worship band playing popular worship songs. They involve very different authority patterns, they involve very different patterns of groups. But when Graham described them to me, they seem to embody a common set of values. And so, it says this: I enjoy playing, and I guess performing as a horn player. And now I can make a fairly reasonable noise. But that's never been the primary purpose for me in terms of worship or in terms of orchestral playing. You want to play your own stuff well, but you're contributing to part of an overall impact. The same is true orchestrally, it was true in the worship context. They were able to bring different impacts through the sound and the quality of what you were able to bring in. And that was then both making for a fuller, richer music and then hopefully helping people to be able to worship. Okay, so both of these different musical worlds in for Graham, centre around the idea of a group of people coming together to create an impact through a shared music-making activity. And this value for him lies at the heart of the music and almost puts all the other kind of differences between them slightly to one side. And this is highlighted by his relative non-interest in listening to recordings or even sitting in an audience. Further on in the interview, he made other connections too. For example, he suggested the importance within an orchestra that it was both literally and metaphorically in tune between the different players, with the coherence of and relationship within the group being the key element to creating good music. In a church setting, he finds the quality of being metaphorically in tune with the congregation and with God to be highly important when leading worship. A sensitivity to others serving to open up a meaningful and powerful experience for those present. So both musical worlds carry this value of in tuneness with other things around you in different senses and different ways, but in both of them it's what makes for good music. And the connection between the musical worlds works both ways. So he later on in the interview he also described the way that orchestral playing carries with it the potential for an awareness of the presence of God and the potential to become a worshipful activity in a way that feels internally similar to his experience on a Sunday. So his experiences begin to demonstrate a little the way his musical attachments become significant for the way he thinks about worship. Actually, what he believes he's doing when he's coming there on a Sunday, and what he believes is important. So his musical experience is one that has a great deal of depth and meaning contained within it. And it's perhaps clear a little from this that this is beginning to move beyond realms of simply individual preference and already touching on questions of community, spirituality, purpose of worship. Okay, a second example. Okay, so someone who I'm going to call Charlotte. For Charlotte, both church worship and musical theatre are the contexts within which she spends a lot of time. And she makes connections between the musical theatre environment and Sunday worship in a similar manner to Graham. For Charlotte, both church worship and musical theatre are to be thought of, to a certain extent, as stage-enabled expressions of emotion taking place within an English culture which rarely allows this kind of expression. Both situations are about undergoing a transformative emotional experience and journey which has the power to shift your own focus and perspective. And the musical element of having a good hearty sing is also key to her experience of Sunday worship. So I'll just quickly read this quote. Although it's not a style of music that I really listen to in any other bit of my life, I do enjoy the music at St. Aldate's. I think one of the things for music that I'm participating in, be that in church or singing or in Gilbert and Sullivan or something, it's nice for there to be something that lets you have a good sing. Particularly, I always think it's quite interesting about worship music that on stage you have lots of people pouring out their emotions and sort of singing love songs or oh woe is me type songs. Because that's happening in a stagey context, it's inevitably going to be slightly artificial. It seems to me that worship music is one of the few points I can think of where people in the course of their everyday lives will use music as a way of expressing their own emotions and feelings. So Charlotte seems to think of Sunday worship partly in terms of musical theatre, like I said. Some of the elements which come to the foreground for experience are already present in the way the church talks about music. Emotion, singing, and the enabling role of worship team are all common topics of conversation about worship. Their emphasis in her experience, however, is quite specific to her. For example, the stage element, which she highlights, is not generally emphasised in the church for fear that worship might be thought of in terms of performance. She clearly has no qualms about this. She draws attention even to the artificial nature of the stage context, as she highlights a way in which it enables a different mode of experience from everyday life. In a similar manner, the element of emotional singing is one that's important within the life of the charismatic church, but within church talk about worship, it would often be something that is supposed to take place on a secondary level, in response to the primary level work of God. Here it's seen almost as a kind of primary transformative element within a service. It takes a very different place. The idea of having a good, hearty sing also strikes against the regular patterns of discourse. The importance of singing passionately from the heart is important in the way the church frames worship music, but hearty singing would not regularly be emphasised in such a way that its secondary role to activity of worship is not made clear. So her description draws attention to aspects of the music which would usually be pushed somewhat to the background. So these two experiences, and they demonstrate how understandings of the church's music and the church's worship can become quite different depending on the other musical environments that people inhabit and the other musical attachments which they form. They also demonstrate a little the way in which the movement between very different musical environments can be smoothed out by the flexibility of music and musical meaning. Church music and the other musics these two people participate in end up being thought of in quite similar terms. The church's music for them already embodies musical characteristics that they find to be valuable, despite being quite different from the music they appreciate elsewhere. So this is perhaps one way in which individuals navigate a world in which the music of church is in some sense not their music. Okay, second category. It's perhaps self-explanatory. It's to do with the kinds of ways in which people can separate the music of church off from other aspects of their musical lives, and the way in which they can occupy contrasting musical worlds through doing so. So we're familiar with this historically, with this kind of separation. Church music, a lot of the time, is supposed to be quite distinct and bounded from the music of the world. Contemporary worship music, on the other hand, is founded partly on the idea of lessening that gap, of forming some continuity there. Nevertheless, it still exists, and there's still a boundary that is often drawn, but it becomes drawn in quite a variety of different ways, and the ways in which it's drawn are quite interesting and meaningful. Again, we're going to look at a couple of different experiences. So, my first is Tom. Tom's an English graduate and is a former intern at St Aldate's. He finds the musical boundary between church and daily life to be significant. He tends to listen to music that he describes as indie, literate, witty, alternative, melancholy, and fairly introspective. And in the interviews, he specifically contrasted this with the atmosphere of a stadium gig. Giant musical collectives, like a stadium gig, are something he would generally avoid. However, expressive charismatic worship in the Sunday service he seems to find largely unproblematic. And when I commented on the similarities between a Sunday setting and some of the qualities he avoids in the larger stadium atmosphere, I got this answer. So he says, "I'm quite an introvert and I tend to process things quite inwardly. But I love the joy of being able to come together in a stadium setting." Well, I say in a stadium, in a church setting. So he's correcting himself, "and declare shared purposes with others, knowing that this is something I've thought through deeply in my own time. I think the music I listen to personally helps me process and helps me work out what I'm actually thinking or shapes my thoughts. Then the music I respond to in church, I appreciate that because it's got a congregational dynamic. It's a response, it's designed to be with a range of different people all coming together to affirm one common faith." So for Tom, there are two counterbalancing poles to his musical life. On one pole is the introspective way in which he processes things and deals with life, not just musically, but intellectually and emotionally. And on the other pole is the confident expression of faith within community. For Tom, neither the reflective music he listens to in private, nor the expressive worship music in church is completely adequate on its own. Instead, he finds that each fulfills a role in relation to the other, together completing the pattern which helps him to navigate life as a believer. Both contribute to his faith, but in different ways appropriate to their setting. The musical expression of church can function for him because it is in a corporate and a sacred setting, and it's not a music that he would engage with either privately or in a group setting outside of the church boundaries. second experience. Nemi, singer on the worship team. She outlines a similar divergence between public and private aspects of her musical life. For Nemi, music is something that takes on a large degree of emotional significance in relation to different people, events and situations as it becomes attached and associated with these. Her own tastes in music are a little different from those of the church. She says they're more messy, more unpredictable. However, she finds the church music is still able to become important for her because it's able to take on emotional significance. It's able to become attached emotionally to different events. But despite these attachments, the music of the church for her doesn't migrate out of worship, either in terms of her listening or in terms of its significance to her. She goes so far as to say that listening to this music elsewhere would be weird. She said this: maybe it's not my style of music, and other than the church and what God is doing in all days, it doesn't have any other significance to me personally. With traditional hymns, on the other hand, I've been singing hymns with my family since I was younger, so I can travel. I can remember things, but with the church in all days, it's just all days. There's a little more to this thing. The music, whilst meaningful in the church, is unable to take on significance outside of that setting because it's not part of a broader network of significant personal associations. But this musical boundary for Nemi also carries a parallel in the personal realm. During the interview, she described how when she forms and enjoys significant friendships, even with members of the church congregation, these are forms enjoyed outside the services rather than finding a place for them inside the church. It seems, during the narrative that she gave me, that emotional, relational and musical boundaries were all bound up in some way together. So both these people interviewed, the boundaries between church music and the other musics of their lives are laden with deeper significance for the way in which they negotiate the world and the way in which they conceive of the church community. The corporate spiritual life of the church is something distinct from the experiences of daily life in specific and meaningful ways. Whilst their experiences within the church are fairly positive and relatively common, the musical features and style carry with them additional significance and relationship to other parts of their musical lives. I want to give one final example in this category before moving on to my final category. This is Claire. Claire finds not that just musical boundaries are present within her life, but that where they're weak, it's important to try and establish them further in order to help her better engage with the music of the church. She says this: because I do the kind of degree where I spend half my time doing really mindless things, and I've done a lot of exercise where music is used to motivate, I've done a lot of like processing as an adolescent where music is used to process, and then a lot of worshipping where music is used for something else. And I guess what I would have been trying to do since I've become a Christian, sorry, this is just the way came across in the interviews, I transcribed it literally, is figure out how to approach these things differently. So she finds within herself a tendency to engage with different musics in the same way is quite unsatisfactory. And she self-consciously seeks to modify her engagement with different musical settings in appropriate ways for these settings. In order to do this, she deprived herself of particular kinds of music for periods of time, specifically to try and modify her own behaviour and her own experiences of the music, and to be able to separate out the music of the church in some way from the musics of other parts of her life. The interplay in her life between activities such as listening to live music on the radio, using recorded music, often Christian, as physical motivation in the gym, watching live streams of Christian worship music online whilst she's working. There's no straightforward division to be made between different parts of her musical life. And it's this sense of blurring and confusion which leads her to seek a clearer sense of distinction. In order for worship music to become something which she can use to engage in the activity of worship, it's necessary for her to go about this work. Otherwise, modes of engagements with music from elsewhere get carried across and prevent her from fully engaging in what she wants to do. So separation of the music of church from other areas of individuals' music, other areas of individuals' musical lives is a second way of navigating situations in which this music is markedly different from the music they appreciate elsewhere. But just like my first category, it's far from straightforward. It has a variety of consequences in a range of significant realms. It alters people's understandings of worship, affects the way in which they relate different parts of their lives together, and the way in which they connect the church to the world around it. My final category. Here we're looking at situations where the transfer of values between different musical worlds can potentially become problematic. What happens when church music doesn't represent the things you've learned to value in music elsewhere? And when those things transfer across as judgments about the music? One common indictment of worship music among people is that it's lowest common denominator music. It's a slightly dismissive way in which people describe contemporary worship music. The description highlights two things. Firstly, it draws attention to the music's perceived poor quality. Low here is clearly a value judgment. Secondly, it highlights on the rationale for having this kind of music thing. The music is chosen and used because it's something which is supposed to be both inoffensive and accessible to people with a wide variety of musical backgrounds and tastes. Often these kinds of factors are held in balance. Individuals' judgments about music can be held in tension against other rationales for the music that they've found ways of coming to terms with. They're not always held in equal balance. A few more experiences. Stephen finds the music of the church to be in many ways a negative experience. Connects his evaluations of it with his appreciation of jazz and hip-hop. He balances this, however, with a desire to change himself and find a way to appreciate it more fully. So this is the quote. Hang on, it's not that quote. Here's that one. Okay. I don't enjoy it, worship music at all. I find it very cheesy. The jazz part of me finds the chords incredibly boring and the melodies incredibly boring. The hip-hop part of me finds the lyrics dreadful and generally empty. I feel that God has helped me to get past a lot of my own silly judgments in these ways and actually to say, well, these worship songs are still truth. And this is still, and you know, singing truth is a wonderful thing. I love the church and I love joining with my brothers and sisters to praise God. So I've kind of found joy in that. But in the music itself, it's a battle. He has a desire to engage with the music of Sunday services, but he feels he lacks the tools to be able to properly understand or get into it. He has a strong sense of what jazz and hip-hop are able to achieve and the qualities that are important within them, but finds it hard to find something within worship music to latch onto in the same way. For him, judgments concerning lyrics that come from his hip-hop background can connect closely with attitudes towards the importance of expressing good theology in songs, whilst this background also carries alongside it a desire for music that does justice to the darker sides of human existence. Stephen is very quick in this interview to adopt an attitude of humility and lay the blame for the situation at his own feet and calls them silly judgments. I find it hard to be quite so dismissive of his experience, which seems to touch on important aspects of human existence and of the church's mission in the world. The first example I gave at the beginning, the very beginning, looked at someone who was able to easily set aside value judgments about worship music as not relevant to the task at hand. But in this particular case, setting aside these judgments doesn't seem to be the appropriate thing to do. Second experience, which is actually that one. This is Ben. Or at least I'm going to call Ben. His experiences in a similar manner draw attention to the close connection that can be felt between musical value judgments and deeper questions of spirituality. Ben's musical home is within such genres as funk, soul, reggae, and disco, as well as playing in a gig context. But he feels stylistically constrained by the imposition of a uniform pop rock style in the church. Because he roots the purpose of music in such things as expressiveness, community, and the soul, he doesn't draw a strong distinction between different musical settings and evaluates them in very similar terms. So he says this: when I play music properly in any setting, it's about the connection between your soul and the other band and whoever's there, and just expressing yourself truly honestly. I totally let go when I'm playing, and that could be in a church setting or a contemporary music pub scene. The difference is that I actually felt for a long time that the church was a better connection, that it was a more true and honest connection to worship, whereas now I'm finding at the moment it isn't necessarily. That's more of the style and the system. It's a slightly cryptic reference at the end. The close relationship which he feels between musical experience and the soul leads him to feel the imposition of stylistic constraint that emerges from certain systems of authority within the church as a constraint of the soul. Music making in a pub setting, therefore, becomes a more authentic location of worship for him than the church itself. He connects control imposed within the worshipping structure of the church very closely to a lack of appreciation for difference, not just in musical style, but of and between people themselves. So here, musical, spiritual, and communal structures are inherently intertwined, such that patterns relating to one of them almost automatically map onto patterns within the others. Musical style and musical value judgments carry with them not just a struggle with particular sounds, but a struggle to engage in particular modes of spirituality, and further, an ethical critique of the structures of the church. Judgments about the music here aren't petty, private matters, and the experience here is probably one that should lead to a certain amount of reflection and conversation rather than being set to one side. I want to give one final experience before I begin to draw out some of the implications very briefly. I want to come back to Claire again. So we've already looked at the way in which she separates out musical worlds. But experiences don't neatly fit into any of my categories. They're my categories and I found them useful, but they're not in any way definitive. Claire finds the church's approach to musical arrangements to be problematic and would very much like them to be more similar in certain ways, some of those found on Radio 1. This desire, however, does not come out of a simple need for her musical tastes to be appealed to, or for the church to keep up in some way with popular culture. Her focus instead is on the way in which secular artists often adapt the songs they do to the particular context that they're performing in. She uses a particular example, Radio 1's Live Lounge. In adapting songs to different contexts, these artists are responsive to the situation in which they're placed and attentive to what's going on around them. Claire often finds that at St Aldate's, by contrast, the same arrangements are often repeated regardless of setting, arrangements which themselves often taken from album recordings. In doing this, she feels that the church fails to respond to what is going on in the congregation or to what the Holy Spirit is doing in a particular situation. I think it might just be an audience thing. They just take on arrangements from CDs. Like all the introductions we ever do ever are ones from, unless Neil has come up with something, they're pretty much just all from other things. I just think you don't do a song the same way, whatever emotional state you're in, and whatever the band's been praying about before a service, they should be able to bring some of that to the arrangement and the worship. Okay, by now you get the picture. I'm saying, what I'm saying, is that people's attachments to and evaluations of musical style are deeply significant in a large variety of ways. And that there are all sorts of interesting connections, separations, and reconceptualizations constantly going on in the way individuals relate church music to other parts of their musical lives. A lot of times, these are quite significant. A few conclusions. Firstly, questions of musical style are, on one level, questions of ethics. We've seen repeatedly how questions of music touch on different aspects of community, spirituality, theology, relationships, emotions. When the church is asking questions of musical style, these are the kinds of issues that are at stake within the lives of the congregation. And their relationships with the church are deeply affected by the church's answers to these questions. There's a deep tradition of historical awareness in the church that music is an ethical medium, in some sense formative of ethical sensibilities. Of course, that is partly what caused the problem here in the first place. This kind of understanding led to the denunciation of rock music, and that in turn led to a counter-reaction that music was not an ethical medium. I think it's possible for a slightly more nuanced understanding to be recovered in a way that acknowledges a degree of flexibility to musical values. Music that carries ethical weight in relationship to particular individuals and communities, and not in particular rigid and predetermined ways. Although that's not to say that the music doesn't contribute something to these relationships. Secondly, a gap. There's a clear gap between institutional discourse and contemporary worship music and experience. So the way the church talks about music a lot of the time and the way people experience it. To focus worshippers purely on their hearts and spiritual attitudes when talking about music and to encourage them to set aside musical questions fails to do justice to the kinds of significance that music takes on for individuals, whilst at the same time putting the music of the church effectively beyond critique. And this makes for tricky pastoral situations where there are relatively few tools available to resolve musical tensions or struggles. I've come across it numerous times on both sides, both on the side of leaders trying to find ways to work with musicians and on the side of congregation members trying to work out what to do with the situations they find themselves in. And we can do better. And hopefully some of the more positive experiences I've outlined in my first two categories begin to shape some of the possibilities for providing fruitful relationships and fruitful ways of negotiating relationships of tension. Thirdly, the conversation. In order to negotiate these questions appropriately, I think there's a need to open up a conversation about the ways in which music does become meaningful and significant both to individuals and to wider church communities. And I think that in doing so, we open up a very interesting space of dialogue. It's a space of dialogue that has often been avoided through fear of what has happened in the past, divisions and arguments that come up. But I think that there are ways of reaching beyond these fears. And I think that thinking of music as an ethical rather than primarily political symbol is perhaps one of the ways that can help to do that. There's often an assumption that what everyone would essentially like is to have their own music represented within the church, therefore seeking some kind of personal control or influence over that musical space. Music therefore becomes a matter of clashing, competing, often irreconcilable differences. By contrast, when questions of ethics, meaning, and significance are opened up on the level I've been discussing, comes the possibility of a space for open exchange and transformation, which different understandings and positions can be juxtaposed, justified, evaluated, and learned from. Ethical positions can at least ideally be justified and transformed in ways that simple claims to power cannot. I'm not suggesting that this will lead to a perfect situation, but I think at least it provides a bit more space to try and go somewhere. Thank you.
Okay, we have a few minutes for questions, so if anyone has some questions for us.
At the back.
You've already mentioned quite a lot the problematic associations with the different categories that you had, or that you identified. I guess I'm interested to know what the people you were talking to felt about their perception of worship, how positive an experience it was for them, in particular how they were able to connect with God through it, and whether you were able to pick up any common characteristics of people who did have more positive experience of worship, whether they fitted into one of your categories more than the others, or whether there were other things that linked them together.
So positive experiences, essentially.
Yeah, and for people who did have a disparity between their secular music world and their congregational music world, what were the common things amongst those who actually were able, despite that, to have a positive worship experience and a connection with God in worship?
I think that's basically what I was trying to get at with my first two categories. So within those categories, these were people where they were inhabiting quite different musics and finding a positive experience. And they were managing to find strategies that enabled to do that, either through kind of this way in which they somehow formed kind of, well, the easy one, the way in which they formed boundaries and kind of sectioned off these areas of musical lives as different things with different standards, different purposes appropriate to them, or the way in which they kind of ended up thinking about the church music in ways that somehow connected to these other musics, despite them being different. There are also some that perhaps fit into this third category as well, that often rely a lot more on kind of ideas of suppressing particular aspects of experience or setting them to one side. I'm never quite sure when people talk about negative judgments and then say, oh, but those don't matter, what they mean or on what level they become significant to them. I think there's a whole scale there. And so some people are able to say, yes, this music's crap, but I enjoy it anyway, and I find that actually for worship, it's great. That can often be a matter of them just dismissing their own dismissal of the music in a way.
I guess my question was particularly around how positive they were. So the people who were most positive, did they tend to fit into one or the other of those first two categories, or were there other things that...
I think there are positive experiences and very positive experiences across the board. I mean, I tend to find that slightly more negative ones a bit more interesting them. I think they raise more questions, and I think the positive ones tend to provide some of the answers to those questions, perhaps. Yes.
I was really intrigued by the comment, I believe it's Charlotte, in your survey here, who mentioned the emotional connection to music.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, in my former parish, quite a few members of the congregation who came from other places or other traditions, one of the reasons they ended up going to my church was that, or the church that I served at, was they were very uncomfortable with any expectation or implied expectation that one is supposed to have some sort of emotional epiphany during singing. And they would talk about how they've been at churches where people raise their hands and things like that. And and they never felt any sort of they never felt some sort of emotional high during music, and they felt like that there was an implied criticism of their own Christianity, that they were failures as Christians because they didn't do that, and so they felt much more comfortable in a parish that had traditional hymns, that where emotion is maybe a little less emphasized and maybe pedagogical value of the hymns are more, are perhaps emphasized equally, if not more so.
Yeah.
To what extent, I mean, do you see that as a factor in your research with contemporary Christian music? I mean, is there an overriding sense that there has to be some sort of emotional impact, and if you don't have that, then you're somehow not successful?
There are certainly people within my field work that brought up precisely that kind of experience, this idea that they're feeling pressured to have some kind of emotional experience. And I think clearly it's a kind of music that does seem geared in that way. I don't think it's a universal one. I think there are quite a range of people I talk to that would frame the music in terms that are able to set the emotional element to one side and think about the music according to completely different priorities. Just trying to think of whether I have any good examples. I mean, even within the preachers and staff members of the church, I talked to some there who found that they would emotionally perhaps, I think the phrase was, kind of have one foot in and whilst they were there, but they were appreciating what they were doing perhaps on grounds more of community or simply actually the idea of worship as an act of devotion. Or even perhaps an older member of the congregation who spent a lot of time, she had impaired vision, so found it hard to read the words, and would spend her time during the worship sets just sitting and reflecting on the lyrics that were being repeated around her, and was adopting a more kind of meditative attitude to it based on that. So people kind of are able to find alternative strategies for dealing with it. Whether that's asking, that's probably asking a lot to expect anyone to be able to do that, because I think the music has a kind of emotional pressure kind of inbuilt in it. But again, I think the church could talk about music and worship in ways that didn't emphasize that so much and provided people with alternative strategies. And I think what I'm arguing for partly in opening up a conversation is that the music of the church might become in some ways responsive to the people in the congregation, as well as them being able to kind of rethink their experiences and find other ways of navigating it.
Thanks, it's really, really fascinating. I sort of wanted to draw a bit on that last question, this question of kind of people feel kind of uncomfortable that an emotional response is being elicited from them. In that sense, it's not. They feel maybe it's not sincere. There was a really interesting one where the guy said, "Oh, you know, I'm an introvert, but I thought these things out for myself privately, and then I come, and because I thought them out privately, then I can sort of let myself go in the music." I thought that's interesting, and you can actually compare it to, you know, other sort of forms of liturgy in other Christian traditions. So, for example, you know, in Catholic or some Anglican traditions, you know, you have the liturgy where you say the same prayers at Mass every week, you know, look not on our sins but on the faith of the Church, and people have exactly the same reactions. You know, sometimes they feel, oh well, this is just the same thing we're saying every week, I don't really feel it, it's just prayers that have been given to me.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they feel, well, I'm sort of giving myself to something that's communal and something that's broader than myself, and it's like a kind of discipline. It's like, you know, I don't always feel this, but by doing what everyone else is doing, I'm participating in the community and I'm being part of something that's larger than myself.
Yeah.
So I suppose from that perspective, there is a value to this, you know, as you're saying, having these conversations and, you know, finding ways in which people can express their preferences better and it can develop. But I guess one also has to maintain a sense of the value of doing things communally that people don't always feel. And sort of sometimes God will give us the grace to feel it and it'll work, and then sometimes it's more of a struggle, I guess.
Yeah. I think I'm not necessarily suggesting that everyone has to have a positive experience in this all the time. I think I'm partly suggesting that the church could provide a greater range of tools to give these people ways in. I mean, I think, for example, a lot of the people I've been interviewed could actually learn quite a lot from the other people I've interviewed in terms of the way they think about the music and how they've come to appreciate it. And I think hearing that for some other person it means this and they approach it in that way can often give someone a way in which they would otherwise have found completely hidden and inaccessible. Sorry, I'm deviating from what you said and it slipped my mind. I lost.
Oh yeah, just that there's, I guess, yeah, there's also a value to this giving yourself to something that's,
yeah,
you know, that's given to you in a sense.
Yeah, so as a discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, that is something that came up a little. People talked about the music of the church as a discipline. And I think, I guess, you want that discipline to be able to lead somewhere. You want it to form in a certain way. Disciplines are meant to go towards kind of greater ends. And so I think if they are approaching it as a discipline, they've got to work out what that end for the discipline is, rather than simply I'm putting myself through this again and again, but I'm not quite sure why. And so finding the goal, which a lot of them have found, even those who find it can be a lot of work, because they've got a goal in mind, the whole thing kind of fits together. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I want to know, if you thought there was any general response to the normative question, what content and style of music ought the church to have? And if so, on what basis can such an answer be given?
Right. I'm slightly avoiding that question by my research, I suppose, by letting people talk about this in their own ways. And in quite a range of ways, I try to step a little bit back and say the style of music a church ought to have should probably in some way be formed in dialogue with the people that are part of the community and what the music does to them. How it becomes significant for them. Which isn't to say church music can't be formational, that you can't use music which does a certain kind of thing to people. But the problem is, if you start just with the music and say, we want a kind of music and it does this thing to people, then you go to talk to people and you find actually it's completely doing 1,000 different things, and maybe 1 in 20 you find that it does to them what you think it should be doing to them, then you're going to have a problem. So it's a matter, partly, I think, theologically, thinking about what can music do, what should it be doing, but then holding that together with what it is actually doing, and then working out how you form a community of musical worship based on holding those two things together. What style should it have? I have no idea. But I think if you find a church and find you begin to think you know what music should do, and then you begin dialoguing with the people who are actually engaging the music, you set a process that can help you to answer those kinds of questions, perhaps. Yeah. Yes.
So really, because the question I would ask is, what is the biblical standard or mandate, you know, for music in the church? I mean, to me, there seems to be a lot of room, massive room. I mean, beyond, you know, in terms of the Bible seems to exhort is praising with all sorts of instruments. Psalm 150, I think it is. So there's a lot of room there. And then in the New Testament, all it seems to say is I can think of the verse where each one bring a song, bring a psalm. Mm. And again, there's a massive room there, isn't there? So,
yeah.
And I just wonder, in that context, do we actually place, typically, I mean, too much importance on the music? Because, again, and I say that with mine, you know, I can think of many conversations that people say, someone's sort of gone to a new church and said, one of the first questions they ask is, what's the style of music? Well, I don't know, should that be the first question you ask? Do you know what I mean? I don't know if others have...
Yeah.
You know, so do we as a generation sort of place too much importance? Anyway, so what's the biggest
I think two parts to answer that question. First, biblically, so it probably doesn't say much specifically about musical style. You get the idea of music primarily through the way it's used in the Psalms, the kinds of texts accompanying it, and you get an impression there. On the other hand, I think my argument perhaps tries to bypass that a little bit and saying, by saying that music is something that tends to be important in terms of the dynamics of communities, the dynamics of spirituality, relationships, emotions, all these kinds of things, the Bible has a lot to say about those kinds of things. Relationships, communities, emotions, spirituality, all these kinds of things. And if you begin to find, I would argue that music is intimately connected to all these dimensions of life. And certainly from talking to people, it seems to be. I think when people talk about music, some of them will talk about sounds, but often they're talking about a lot of other things as well. And I think it's on that level that you can begin to ask, what does the Bible have to say? Because it has a lot to say about these other aspects. And so then when you get to the question of, should the question of style be one of the first things you ask, in terms of purely the sounds, maybe not, but in terms of what the style actually says about quite a range of dimensions of human existence, probably it can be an important question. So it depends on what level you're asking the question, really.
On that note, so when you got to your conclusions and it mentioned having an ongoing conversation about music and ethics.
Yeah.
And I think this, I guess, directly ties into what you've just said, right? But I wondered what do you think are some first steps for creating those kinds of conversations?
I think it often can be a struggle in certain kinds of church context to go about this kind of task, either because you've got a church which is very large and there's a ridiculous number of people to try and engage, which is perhaps somewhere like St. Aldate's encounters as a problem, or because you know that the church has tried to have these kinds of make musical changes in the past and they cause divisions and arguments and whatever. I think it's the kind of question that's easiest to ask in kind of small, mid-sized groups. I think that you start talking to people about music and all these things just begin coming up. I find if you open the space over coffee for them to talk about it, it kind of happens. And then what do you do with it? I think you begin doing something about it in the smaller settings, say in places. I mean, St. Aldate's deliberately fosters a range of small group settings, and I think those can be useful places for these kinds of things to be talked about. I often, the musical leaders, just by talking to the people they're leading, will find that these people have enough opinions anyway. It's a matter of opening them up in the right way and probing them in the right kind of way. I think one of the things we did, for example, at the Lent services was, which was a series of kind of smaller services we did at St. Audit's over Lent, just in the East End, was to begin to probe different people in different ways and ask different questions of what can music do, what's it doing here, what can this person bring, how are they experiencing the music? And it didn't necessarily lead to anything particularly coherent straight away. It provided a bit of space. I think providing small bits of space is the way to start, where people feel free to talk about the way these things are important to them.
Is commercialization a problem for the ethical side of what you're talking about? For me, it's a pertinent issue at the moment because I've got a friend in New York who writes his own Christian music, and he's got a publisher, and the cost of having a publisher is that he now has to produce music that the producer thinks the hearers want to hear rather than the music that he himself feels called to produce. And so things become more synthetic, and then it feeds back from the recording in back into the local church itself. Is commercialism the enemy of authenticity and ethics within music? Is our problem really more with commercialism rather than with modes of music?
I think on some level it can be. I think one of the things I find hardest to deal with about the commercialization side is the way it often leads to a certain amount of empire building, and you'll have one very influential center which wants to replicate their model across the globe, kind of without necessarily too much attention to context. And I think that can often lead to a slightly unthinking engagement with music. You're adopting something purely because they happen to be rolling it out. I mean, on the other hand, commercialization goes hand in hand with a certain amount of diversification, a certain amount of access to a range of products and ways of engaging with music that can also be quite democratizing and quite empowering and quite resourcing. So I guess on the one hand it can lead to quite oppressive kind of existences, and on the other hand, if it's engaged within the right kind of way, I think it needn't. Yes?
I was just thinking, because you did it at St. Aldate's, just knowing that the musical quality there is at a certain level, I'm wondering whether, I mean, it's purely a kind of in the air question.
Yeah.
Because if you want to be in the worship band at St. Aldate's, you would have to audition, you'd have to be able to play to a certain standard.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether the opinions of a congregation where you don't have as many musically talented people would have been stronger, do you know what I mean?
It's stronger in what way?
As in, like, they would be much more, maybe more dismissive of contemporary worship music. Because if you go to a church where there's somebody that can just about play a guitar, and then there's somebody playing a recorder,
right,
or something, you know what I mean? Like, if the sound isn't really, like, perfect and cohesive, and everyone's playing a tune, that maybe that would affect how people feel about that type of.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how they conceive of their community. Say there's one person I interviewed who spans a couple of different church contexts, both within this kind of charismatic tradition and both with differing levels of quality. But the level of quality also seemed to relate to what they thought was important in terms of what the music is and what it's doing. So is it a kind of slick kind of sound that recedes the background? Is it an expression of what we are as community and what the different people within our group can contribute? I think even you do get smaller churches often aspiring to do things which they simply cannot pull off particularly well, but you also get them opening up contributions from a range of people, that if people are beginning to think of the music as an expression of the things that their community can offer, often matters more to them, and they actually appreciate more than something that's more slick and polished. So again, it comes down to how you're thinking about the music, what you think is important about it, and why, how the church frames that, and how the individuals within the congregation also experience and approach that, and it varies. Yeah.
Let's thank Mark one more time. Please do feel free to linger a while and finish off the nibbles that are around and continue this conversation. But that's it formally for us this evening. Do join us next week for Miriam Jones. It's bound to be great. And if you'd like, the sign-up sheet will be here. We go. So thank you very much.
John, I'm going to meet you.